Chapter 30. According to Mark Sinclair, Richard Colmer's fury exploded when, one day, he discovered his wife and Johnny Ray cuddling in the townhouse. In a rage, he threatened to kill the singer if he ever saw the two together again, an indication of the temper he possessed when in an alcoholic state. Those who believed Richard was complicit in Kilgallen's death apparently included her mother, May. Although this account has been disputed, to the dismay of many, a fiery exchange between Richard and her after Kilgallen's funeral disclosed May's belief that her daughter had not died accidentally. Glancing at a photo of May and Richard in the Journal American during his videotaped interview, as posted at thedorothykilgallenstory.org, Mark Sinclair said, "They, May and Richard, had a big fight. It says down at the bottom of the newspaper page that they are fighting, and May's pointing a finger at Richard and said, 'You killed my daughter and I will prove it,' and Jim Kilgallen took her away. If Richard, who was home, as noted in Kilgallen's autopsy report, when she arrived after being seen at the Regency Hotel bar following her last What's My Line performance, harmed his wife through an overdose of drugs, thus poisoning her, how would he have done it? The answer lies in his affinity for barbiturates, especially Tuinol. To that end, Carey told author Lee Israel, for her book Kilgallen, that his father had vats of pills around, containers of Tuinol large enough to pickle mice. This suggests Richard certainly had the means by which to have spiked a drink his wife enjoyed when she returned home, or tricked her into taking more pills she may have requested to help her sleep than her heart could stand, since Tuinol was one of the drugs found in her blood. Evidence of Richard's access to the drugs has been confirmed by others. During March 1965, when Kilgallen was hospitalized for a fractured left shoulder, Pearl Bauer, an assistant to Kilgallen's secretary Myrtle Verne, said, "Richard brought Kilgallen pills and liquor that damn near killed her." If indeed Kilgallen requested more sleeping pills when she arrived home, and Richard deliberately spiked her drink with the powerful Tuinol, along with the other barbiturates, he was guilty of premeditated murder. If he simply mixed too much Tuinol and the other drugs into her drink, causing her death, the charge could have been manslaughter. Mark Sinclair's discovery of Kilgallen's body a few minutes after 9 o'clock a.m. must have been a shock to Richard, as Sinclair, referring to butler James Clement while not implicating him in her death, stated in his videotaped interview, "James was very nervous because I wasn't supposed to be there. I was not supposed to find the body." This is why Clement ran so hurriedly up the steps. As Sinclair stated, "They didn't expect me to come. No one knew I was coming to the townhouse." They would certainly have included Richard. Recall that the police were not notified of Kilgallen's death until mid-afternoon, much later than Sinclair appeared on the scene. And when they did arrive, by all accounts, including that of actress Joan Crawford, Richard was in a sad state. Phyllis Cerf, wife of Bennett, told Sinclair, "Richard was dead drunk. They were trying to sober him up." Jean Stralam, a friend of the Colmers, said, "Dick was in his chair crying, so drunk, so upset, so in tears." The question is, was Richard drunk and upset over the loss of his wife, or because he somehow was responsible for her death? Richard's conduct after Kilgallen died is riddled with falsehoods, including what he told Dr. Luke within a short time after the medical examiner appeared on the scene. Recall that, listed under the section Witnesses or Informants, it included, in part, Richard's account. "Dorothy returned from What's My Line last p.m., 11:30 p.m., feeling chipper. Went in to write column. Husband said goodnight and went to bed. Wife, no past history of alcoholism or other medicinal habits." Based on other accounts, Richard's statements were false. Witness Bob Bach, who had been with Kilgallen after midnight at P.J. Clark's. Most revealing is that Richard said Kilgallen went in to write column, apparently at 11:30 p.m. This version conflicts with accounts of others who saw her at the Regency Hotel bar past midnight. What Richard said about Kilgallen's JFK assassination file adds to suspicion that he was involved in her death. 3 days after she died, Jean and Bob Bach invited Richard to dinner. Bob asked, "Dick, what was all that stuff in the folder Dorothy carried around with her about the assassination?" Richard replied, "Robert, I'm afraid that will have to go to the grave with me." Later, Kilgallen's friend Mark Lane, with whom she shared her JFK assassination investigation findings, asked Richard about the file. He said, "I'm going to destroy all that. It's done enough damage already." Lane did not follow up with a question as to why the file had done enough damage already. Recall that Richard listened while Lane and Kilgallen discussed her JFK investigation at the townhouse. What Richard may have ascertained about Kilgallen's file is unknown, or if Mark Sinclair is correct that Richard's unhappy state of mind wasn't indicative of his having the secrets to the JFK assassination, then perhaps Richard never possessed Kilgallen's secret file at all, but instead lied about having done so. In his videotaped interview, Sinclair commented on the whereabouts of the assassination file, stating, "If anyone knew other than Dorothy about the whereabouts of the file, it would be Richard." A Dallas resident, James Hollingsworth, with inside information about Richard's mental makeup at the time, told this author he disputed Richard's account of throwing the file away. Johnny Ray told his manager Alan Eichler that Dorothy would have never trusted Richard with the file at all, since he was an alcoholic and, as a result, unreliable. Ray's friend, journalist and biographer Johnny Whiteside, described the contents of Kilgallen's JFK assassination file in his book Cry. Unlike most of the crackpots and paranoids who swiftly joined the chorus, Dorothy's suspicions were grounded on apparent fact and backed up by intense research. Her coverage of the case, before and after the Warren Report, was the most aggressive and in-depth being done. Kilgallen not only anticipated many of the theories since endlessly propounded, she was able to explore and attempt to verify specifics at a time when the trail was still fresh. Dorothy's political and underworld contacts were unrivaled within the Fourth Estate. If any reporter had the capability to follow a chain of conspiratorial evidence to its end, it was Dorothy. While Richard must be a prime suspect in Kilgallen's death, Mark Sinclair, for one, said in his interviews that he did not believe Richard had the guts to deliberately kill her. Even though he hated his wife for her affair with Johnny Ray and was upset to learn that she was changing her will to protect Kerry since she wasn't certain Richard would take care of him, it's a stretch to believe that Richard killed her, unless he accidentally on purpose gave her an overdose of barbiturates. This conclusion points to the second main suspect in Kilgallen's death, a powerful man Marilyn Monroe also knew quite well for years on end. When listing those who could have orchestrated Kilgallen's death, without doubt, Frank Sinatra, an archenemy of Kilgallen's, must be part of the list. The sleazy singer and roughneck whose propensity for violence was well known escalated a public feud way beyond columnist and performer to something personal between the two powerful celebrities. The two megastars hadn't always been at odds. In fact, Kilgallen had written great reviews about Sinatra during the early days of his career. In addition, she later permitted the singer of such hit songs as My Way, That's Life, and It Was a Very Good Year to write her Voice of Broadway column when she vacationed, with the announcement stating, "Dorothy Kilgallen is on vacation. Her guest columnist today is the eminent crooner Frank Sinatra." Sinatra then began the column with the headline, "The Business of Warbling," before adding, The question I run across most frequently is, what is the most important experience in becoming a singer? He continued, Well, thanks to Dorothy and the column she's given me, I'll attempt to answer that, and in doing so, I'll perhaps give some young boy or girl just starting out some advice that will help, advice based on my own experience. Another indication of Kilgallen's admiration for Sinatra is based on a photoplay article in June 1944 entitled, The Stars I'd Like to Be Married To. Number one was Sinatra, with her comment, He heads the list just because, well, you guess why, Frank's used to getting screamed at by young fans, so he's less likely to fall prey to the next pretty wolf in sheep's clothing who tries to steal him away, and besides, he'll sing to you. Unfortunately, in early 1956, the friendship faltered and the feud had begun, when Kilgallen wrote several scathing articles about Sinatra, the Kennedy family friend and mafia-connected singer, for a Journal American series titled The Real Frank Sinatra Story. Included in the article was the mention of Sinatra being friends with such killers as the dangerous Fischetti brothers, Rocco and Charles, cousins of the legendary Al Capone. Regarding Sinatra's overall way of life, Kilgallen wrote, Success hasn't changed Frank Sinatra. When he was unappreciated and obscure, he was hot-tempered, egotistical, extravagant, and moody. Now that he is rich and famous, with the world on a string and sapphires in his cufflinks, he is still hot-tempered, egotistical, extravagant, and moody. Striking back, Sinatra featured Kilgallen in his nightclub act. He told audiences she looks like a chipmunk. Sinatra must have been jealous of Kilgallen's extended popularity. Johnny Ray's biographer, Johnny Whiteside, observed, Rules must be followed. That was how they played it in Gotham. But Dorothy Kilgallen was in a position to change the rules any time it suited her, and everyone from the mayor on down to mobster Frank Costello, who occasionally joined her table at P.J. Clark's, knew it. In her articles, which Bennett Cerf praised as wonderful on the February 26, 1956 airing of What's My Line, Kilgallen, who at this time was rumored to not only be smitten with evangelist Billy Graham, but motion picture star Marlon Brando, no proof of this exists, detailed Sinatra's various romances with, among others, Gloria Vanderbilt, Kim Novak, Lana Turner, and Ava Gardner. She added, A few of the women, like Ava and Lana, were public idols themselves and priceless examples of feminine beauty. Many more, of course, have been fluffy little struggling dolls of show business, pretty and small-waisted and similar under the standard layer of peach-colored pancake makeup. They are starlets who never got past first base in Hollywood, assorted models and vocalists and chorus girls now lost in the ghosts of floor shows past. Others belonged to the classification most gently described as tawdry. In turn, Sinatra derided Kilgallen's chinless appearance, dubbing her the chinless wonder. She responded by writing more about his mafia connections. This included associating him with Chicago gangster Sam Giancana and L.A. crime boss Mickey Cohen, the same Mickey Cohen that Gianni Russo connected to the death of Marilyn due to Cohen's enforcer, Joe DiCarlo, as previously noted. An LAPD report confirmed Sinatra's relationship with Cohen. It detailed discovering Sinatra's address in Cohen's personal address and telephone book. The memo also described how, on December 23, 1946, Mickey Cohen asked Jimmy Tarantino to get Frank Sinatra to come over to Cohen's house, and Cohen later attended one of Sinatra's broadcasts where he sat on stage. And finally, that on one occasion, Cohen accused an unknown individual of having threatened Sinatra. In the final paragraph, confirmation of Kilgallen's alleging that Sinatra and the Fischetti brothers were friends is confirmed through another column, written by Denton Walker in the February 28, 1957 edition of the Washington Times-Herald. Walker wrote, "Frank Sinatra was the Miami Beach House guest of the Fischetti Boys of Chicago, and flew with them to Havana, which is how he happened to see Lucky Luciano, which is expected to get bigger as time goes on." What Walker meant by "get bigger" is unknown. Meanwhile, one evening, Sinatra walked by Kilgallen at the Stork Club. Noticing that she was wearing sunglasses, he dropped a dollar bill in her coffee cup. Then he said to a friend, "I always figured she was blind." In another seething column answering a reader complaint about JFK being friendly with Sinatra, she called the singer a successful tough guy who refers to women as broads and gets off airplanes with a drink in his hand. In the true Sinatra fashion, no rules and plenty of booze and girls anywhere you look. At an appearance at the Copacabana, owned by Frank Costello, in New York City, Sinatra, called by Elvis Presley a cretinous goon, hit Kilgallen with a nasty diatribe of his own. As a part of his act, he told the audience, "Dorothy Kilgallen couldn't be here tonight. She's out shopping for a new chin." He then added, to laughter and applause, "Come on, let's all chip in and buy Dorothy a new chin," before lifting his glass toward the fans. "This is a toast to my enemies," Sinatra shouted before spitting the whiskey to the floor. He then added, "That one was for Dorothy Kilgallen." When friends told Sinatra that he was berating Kilgallen too often, he roared, "I'm not being rough enough." During a performance at the Sands Hotel, he held up a car key while asking the cheering audience, "Doesn't this look like Dorothy Kilgallen's profile?" Another quip was Sinatra telling his audience, "If you run into Kilgallen, do it driving a car." Later, Sinatra, while performing at the Villa Venice outside Chicago with Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr., said, "I've met many, many male Finks, but I've never met a female Fink until I met Dorothy Kilgallen. How's that for an opener? I wouldn't mind if she was a good-looking Fink. The town where she came from had a beauty contest when she was 17 years old, and nobody won." After learning of Kilgallen's death from his PR man, Jim Mahoney, Sinatra showed little concern. He calmly said, "Dorothy Kilgallen's dead. Well, guess I gotta change my whole act." In November 1961, Kilgallen was asked by a Time magazine reporter about the rift with Sinatra and why he had gone to such extremes to badmouth her, attempted to soil her reputation with personal attacks on how she looked, deficiencies such as being the chinless wonder. Kilgallen's answer was simple. "Sinatra's personal attacks are for one reason and one reason only, because I resisted his sexual advances." No specific information was provided, but apparently Sinatra never defended himself against the accusations. While Sinatra definitely hated Kilgallen and had motive to see her eliminated, proving his culpability is difficult without new evidence surfacing. Certainly his mob connections extending into NYC made it possible for him to order a hit on his archenemy, bringing to mind a quote from his mother Dolly. She had said of him, "Yes, my son is like me. You cross him, he never forgets." This son, Kilgallen's enemy, had mafia connections in New York City and around the country. His close friendships included gangsters Charles Lucky Luciano, Sam Giancana, Frank Costello, Bugsy Siegel, Mickey Cohen, and Tampa crime boss Santo Trafficante. As noted, in 1947, Sinatra had flown to Havana. There he frolicked with all of the heads of the U.S. crime families, including Carlos Marcello, Luciano, Mickey Cohen, and others. FBI reports obtained through the Freedom of Information Act confirm that Sinatra gave Melvin Belli's client, Mickey Cohen, $20,000, $150,000 in today's currency. This happened after the gangster's release from prison during the days following the Dallas assassinations, and within days after Cohen received a cash gift from Carlos Marcello, he was the first person that Cohen visited after his release from the penitentiary. At one point, Sinatra visited Cohen's L.A. home, requesting that the gangster attempt to mend the singer's ongoing feud with actress Ava Gardner. On another occasion, when Sinatra's career was waning, Cohen organized a testimonial for him at the swank Beverly Hills Hotel. "I love Frank," Cohen said. "I have a very great respect for him, and even when he was at his worst, I was his best friend." Sinatra's connections to Frank Costello and Mickey Cohen stretched from coast to coast. In California, Sinatra became close friends with Cohen after he assumed control of the L.A. Mafia. This happened following Bugsy Siegel's murder. Sinatra worshipped Siegel, the West Coast Mafia chief for Murder, Inc. Sinatra admitted he wanted to emulate Siegel, with the two men sharing certain similarities. These included being notorious womanizers who took flamboyant lovers, traveled with entourages, possessed ferocious tempers, and had grandiose visions of empire building. Frank Sinatra certainly had the motive to eliminate Kilgallen, and benefited from her being dead. Regarding means and opportunity, if the crooner decided she needed killing, he would have never dirtied his hands with such a nasty task. But he did have his mafia friends at hand. Any of them could have handled the assignment if Sinatra had given the go-ahead, but proving he did, as noted, is difficult to do unless new evidence surfaces. According to the singer's FBI file, Frank Sinatra pimped for John Kennedy. The notation read, "It was a known fact that the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas was owned by hoodlums, and that while the senator, Kennedy, Sinatra, Peter Lawford were there, showgirls from all over town were running in and out of the senator's suite. Little question exists that Marilyn had a long-running affair with the crooner, as evidenced by her appearance at his performance at the Sands Hotel in June of the year before she died. An indication of the close nature of the relationship exists in the form of a memo distributed to the media, which read, 'Marilyn Monroe will be Mr. Sinatra's guest. It is Mr. Frank Sinatra's intention that Miss Monroe be accorded the utmost privacy during her brief stay at the Sands. She will be registered in Mr. Sinatra's suite. Under no circumstances is she or Mr. Sinatra to be disturbed by telephone calls or visitors before 2 p.m. During this time, Sinatra had given Marilyn a miniature white poodle, which, ironically, she named Muff, short for Mafia. The Las Vegas casino boss, previously quoted, told this author in April 2020, "Frank certainly did care about her. He had a side to him that wanted to look out for the injured, and she was one of them. I heard he even paid the bills for a psychiatrist she was seeing." Nearly 1 year before Marilyn was found dead, a photograph of the two aboard Sinatra's yacht was taken. It showed Marilyn wearing a white blouse and white pants, her eyes hidden behind sunglasses, next to Frank. The expression on her face is one of joy, that unforgettable smile of hers glowing as Frank gazes into the horizon. The rough-and-tumble Sinatra's temper had wreaked havoc on many a member of the media when they intruded on his lifestyle. In one instance, he had beaten up a Hollywood reporter. But each time, when criminal charges appeared on the horizon, his influential friends in higher places made the charges go away. Gianni Russo described how Sinatra's temper led to the beating of Shecky Green, who Russo described as a very talented comic, singer, and storyteller. Apparently, Green made the mistake of echoing fun-loving comments made by Sinatra's close friend Don Rickles, who jokingly called Sinatra a skinny guinea. Green started doing so as well in his nightclub act, and when Sinatra learned of the comments, which he called rude and disrespectful, according to Russo, he told Green to cut it out. Green ignored the order, and one evening after his Vegas nightclub act, three goons took Green into an alley and, Russo said, beat the shit out of him before Sinatra walked into the alley and said, "Okay, that's enough." Another account of Sinatra the Tough Guy appeared in singer Paul Anka's book, My Way. He wrote, There was the night in 1967 when he ran up a $500,000 gambling debt at the Sands, where he was headlining, then disappeared for the weekend. He certainly didn't come back apologetic. Continuing, Anka said, Sinatra seized one of the golf carts used for luggage, plunked his wife, Mia Farrow, in the passenger seat, and drove it into the glass entryway, shattering it. Anka says Sinatra wasn't angry at the moment, just very, very drunk. So drunk, he kept trying to set fire to curtains in the lobby, but couldn't manage to start a blaze. But soon afterward, Anka writes, Sinatra was furious enough to call for a hit on the manager of the Sands, Carl Cohen. Howard Hughes had taken over, and the game had changed. Sinatra was being refused his gratis markers, and he was used to getting $50,000 worth of free chips. As Anka described it, Sinatra jumped on a blackjack table, bringing all the action in the casino to a halt as he raged and cursed. Anka and Sinatra then moved to the coffee shop, where Cohen showed up to make peace. Anka wrote, The first thing Sinatra did was hurl a chair at Cohen's security guard. Still, Cohen tried to calm him, explaining that Hughes was in charge and certain things couldn't be done. Sinatra responded by ripping away the tablecloth, spilling scalding hot coffee into Cohen's lap. Anka also revealed the sordid details of the Rat Pack in his memoir. At one point, he recalled that after Sinatra embarrassed him, Carl Cohen punched Sinatra in the face, and the singer's dental caps flew out of his mouth. Anka helped hustle Sinatra out before the cops arrived. He was quickly on a Learjet to L.A., where he got his teeth done and plotted revenge. Sinatra puts the word out to the boys he wants Carl dead, Anka wrote. But the boys said no. You have to understand, the mob still ran the place, and Carl was one of the boys from Cleveland. Controversial author Kitty Kelly certainly knew the extent of Frank Sinatra's wrath. On May 17, 1988, according to the British publication The Daily Mail, she revealed the terrors she faced while writing her book on the singer entitled His Way. After revealing that she had been sued by the singer in 1983 for more than $2 million for researching the biography, she wrote, Frank had no hesitation about using the U.S. judicial system to intimidate anyone from trying to write about him. That is the Sinatra I knew, controlling and so powerful he could dictate what the public knew about him. While writing the book, Kelly said, Interviewing hundreds of people to research his life story was frightening. To a man and a woman, they were scared of the physical violence that might come to them for talking to me. I interviewed grown men who were convinced they, and in some cases their families, would be killed if they talked about Sinatra. As for me, I felt dogged by danger every step of the way. On many occasions, when Sinatra was accused of a crime, victims and witnesses suddenly disappeared or dropped charges when paid to do so. One primary source who witnessed the Sinatra method of dealing with those who offended him was Kennedy family friend Peter Lawford. When a violent argument between the two men happened after Lawford dined with Sinatra's love interest, Ava Gardner, Lawford said of the crooner, I was panicked. I mean, I was really scared. Frank's a violent guy, and he's good friends with too many guys who'd rather kill you than say hello. In October 1961, Kilgallen had written a searing, lengthy column where she acknowledged Sinatra's talents as well as his fame while still pointing out his many flaws. She wrote, I have received many letters like this one, and included what she'd received. Dear Miss Kilgallen, I would find my day lost if I missed your column. Therefore, I would like your opinion why the president and his charming wife would entertain a person such as Frank Sinatra at their home, while the president's brother, Robert Kennedy, is supposed to be going to investigate Sinatra's friends, the Fischettis, gangsters. Mary Ann Nolan. In the column, Kilgallen replied, Miss Nolan, you and all the others who wrote to me are an admirable but naive minority. the majority of people in this country admire, openly or secretly, a successful tough guy who refers to women as broads and gets off airplanes with a drink of whiskey in his hand. I suppose a parlor psychiatrist would deduce there are a great many conforming milquetoasts in this land who would give anything to be cut loose from the wife and kids and the mortgage and community mores and live in the Sinatra fashion, no rules and plenty of booze and a girl anywhere you look. In any case, next to President Kennedy, Frank Sinatra is the biggest man in America today. He is rich, powerful, and adored by millions of fans. He is more famous than any writer, philosopher, clergyman, or poet. If you don't believe me, walk down your own street and ask the first 50 people you meet who is the author of the last Pulitzer Prize novel. Ask them who is Bertrand Russell. Ask them what Robert Frost does for a living. You'll be surprised at the blank looks. But ask them who Frank Sinatra is, and you'll get 50 right answers. So why shouldn't President Kennedy entertain him if he wants to? The election is over. He won it. In this photograph, circa 1950, Sinatra is surrounded by many of his other mafia friends. Gianni Russo, previously mentioned as the author of Hollywood Godfather with Patrick Piccarelli, told this author, "I was there that night at the Westbury Music Fair in the mid-1950s, in Westbury, Long Island, when that photo was taken. The Gambino crime family controlled the ticket sales, and there was a big scandal, and a few people went to jail because of them scalping the Sinatra concert tickets and many other performers' tickets." Russo added, "The gentlemen in the photo include Carlo Gambino, Paul Castellano, Greg De Palma, and Tommy Bilotti. Castellano and Bilotti were shot in front of Sparks Steakhouse in New York City by John Gotti's crew. That's when Gotti took control of the Gambino crime family and announced that he was now the boss." While many questioned Sinatra's actual involvement with the underworld, the photo speaks for itself. 8 suit-and-tie mobsters, each a killer, treating the crooner as if he was a member of the family. Regarding additional suspects who had reason to see Dorothy Kilgallen erased from the face of the earth, it may very well be that Sinatra's hatred of Kilgallen paled in comparison to that of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover and the FBI had long considered Kilgallen a threat, even though one file entry, as noted, had called her flighty and irresponsible. No matter, Hoover knew Kilgallen was at the hub of several worlds, including Broadway and Hollywood and the journalistic kingdom, and most importantly, had the best sources for inside information of any of the famous newspaper columnists of the day. In addition, 2 FBI files indicate the FBI's surveillance of Kilgallen, including employment of an informant to infiltrate the P.J. Clark's weekly Science Club meeting that Kilgallen and her friends enjoyed. The memo stated, "Dick Colmer operates the Left Bank restaurant on West 50th Street. The informant advised Kilgallen goes there about once or twice a week, and she stated that Colmer has been dating other women. He has his own private apartment and office on the 3rd floor of the building. Colmer is or has been interested in both sexes, and Colmer showed interest in the informant. Informant stated under the pretext of discussing the presentation of her artwork in the Left Bank, he induced her to go to his private room at the Left Bank and there attempted to make intimate advances." Concerning Kilgallen, the memo stated, "Dorothy Kilgallen and her husband Richard Colmer have their own private lives, and Kilgallen is active in a group called the Science Club, which meets on Mondays for luncheon at P.J. Clark's bar. The informant has attended several of these meetings." The informant also advised that Miss Kilgallen has been extremely attentive and apparently attracted to the singer Johnny Ray. When J. Edgar Hoover shouted to the world his Oswald alone theory, the general public was convinced that some nut was responsible for JFK's assassination. This provided closure, the belief that there weren't multiple assassins on the loose who might cause more havoc, for instance, with government officials. While ordering the Justice Department to focus on Oswald and Oswald alone, and thus disregard any thought of a conspiracy, Hoover was protecting himself, since if there had been a plot to kill JFK, he could be held responsible. Heading everyone in the media toward the Oswald alone theory was smart business, but there was one and only one journalist who hadn't believed his sermon, Dorothy Kilgallen. Just 7 days after JFK's assassination, Kilgallen had begun her assault with a scathing column attacking Hoover's theories. At one point, it may be recalled, he became so infuriated with what she was writing that he had written in capital letters, "Wrong, wrong," across a column she wrote. Based on Kilgallen's criticism of the Oswald alone theory perpetuated by Hoover, he could have orchestrated her death to silence his adversary. Eliminating her and confiscating and destroying her thick JFK and Oswald assassination files, close friend Marlon Swing said, Dorothy had notes and notes and notes and they all disappeared, would have ended any chance he could be blamed for JFK's demise in the book Kilgallen was writing for Random House. If that had happened, Hoover could very well have been called before a grand jury with the risk that he might be indicted for obstruction of justice based on the evidence Kilgallen had collected. Embarrassed when the famous reporter exposed Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission's release date, he had growing reasons to put into action a plan to silence Kilgallen. Part of that plan was apparently carried out, at least in part, when James Clement answered the door to Kilgallen's lavish townhouse on East 68th Street in the late morning on that tragic day of her death, a chillier than normal November 8, 1965, 17 days shy of Thanksgiving. As a stiff wind hit him in the face, Clement, based on the reliable first-hand account of his daughter Brenda Desjardins, was alarmed when a flood of FBI agents, or those stating they were FBI agents, swarmed into the hallway. His voice tempered with a bit of fear, Clement apparently inquired as to why they were there, but received no explanation. The agents, Clement told his daughter, headed for the third floor. This is where, according to Desjardins, he had already been surprised to discover, after a thorough search of the townhouse, that the body of the woman he loved like a sister was not in the third-floor bathroom, where he had been the first one to discover it much earlier, but now in the master bedroom adjacent to her dressing room. Realizing Kilgallen's body had been moved, he informed the agents of this strange development, but was told not to say anything to anyone about where the body had been first located or their presence in the townhouse. To his chagrin, Clement, a mild-mannered but strong man of character who had been hired by Kilgallen and her husband Richard Colmer after she was impressed with him and his wife Evelyn, an excellent cook, at a friend's dinner party, kept asking questions as the men flittered about, faces stern, all business, but he was ignored. The agents informed him Kilgallen had apparently died of an accidental drug overdose, but the butler did not believe this could be possible. Several hours would elapse before New York City detectives and the medical examiner entered the townhouse, but what bothered Clement most was watching the agents confiscate boxes of Kilgallen's papers and documents and carry them away. Sweating profusely, the butler told his daughter he raised his hands in protest while confronting the man who appeared in charge, but the actions only prompted a warning, "Keep your mouth shut." Based on Clement's shocking account, it seems logical to believe that Hoover, upon learning of Kilgallen's death or having been complicit in her death, had quickly taken action and, to that end, ordered his agents or rogue agents borrowed from clandestine operatives to raid the townhouse. Doing so points directly to Hoover, who had perhaps more to lose than anyone if Kilgallen nailed him in her book as having covered up the truth about the JFK assassination, being a murderer through the efforts of soldiers he sent in for the kill. Now, with her being dead, the despicable head of the FBI, a man with no morals or ethics, just like the Kennedys, was home free from any indictment, which is exactly what happened.